Today, in part four of our series, Stories to be Shaped By, the topic is building on rock or sand from Matthew 7. Is it enough just to say the right things? What about doing the right things? How do we build a foundation for life on rock? What happens if we build on sand instead? Have you accepted the authority of Jesus over your life? Here's Pastor Seth.
We're doing a series called Stories to be Shaped By. Over the last couple weeks, I've had some pretty tough phone calls with some folks around the country that I know. One particular man did something incredibly stupid, and his wife, not that that's all that unusual for any of us, but his wife found out about it. And in order to try to minimize the damage that he saw was about to unfold, he lied about it in an effort to try to not make it worse. When it was discovered that he had lied about it, he discovered it made things about 100 times worse. The man is a friend of mine, going to church for a lot of years. Another friend of mine... Raised his daughter. He's got several kids. Raised his daughter. She just graduated from high school. She's been going to community college. And out of the blue, she started dating a guy, and out of the blue told her dad that that they're going to move in together. My friend is devastated. She's going up in church, Sunday school, youth group. Not like it's her first rodeo, and not like this is just something to, you know, that she doesn't know better. Another conversation I had was with a wife in a difficult marriage, and as we were talking, I realized that the only time that she is open to physical affection with her husband is when she feels affectionate. Not uncommon for a wife to live that way, think that way. This is a good woman in church a lot of years. If you asked her, what's the definition of holiness and what does it mean to be holy, she could give you a proper theological definition of holiness. To be set aside, to be set apart for God's purposes in the lives of other people. She could quote that. And yet she sees absolutely no connection between that theological concept of being holy, set apart for God's purposes in the lives of the people around her, and her insistence that physical affection happen only when she feels affectionate. Now, when I think about these three conversations, I think about what are the commonalities in all of them, and all of them have to do with sort of what we're talking about in our parable today, the parable of the foundation between building our life on rock and building our life on sand. Or building our life on the gospel, or building our life on what we substitute for the gospel. It's very easy to, as a Christian, to start out with the realization that that I am a Christian strictly because of the mercy and grace of God and what Jesus Christ did for me on the cross, and that I need him to be the Lord of my life instead of me being the Lord of my life, and we get rolling on that down that road. That's a good road. But at some point, it's very easy to sort of substitute a different gospel, the gospel of something like, but isn't what God's trying to do to make me happy? And shouldn't the gospel sort of go along that line? It's easy to make that substitute. In some churches, the real, maybe not stated, but the real goal of spiritual maturity or the measurement is what I know about Scripture. Now, you are listening to a Baptist preacher. As important as Scripture is, that is not the final measurement of spiritual maturity, what I know about the Bible. It's easy to substitute that. Another one is we substitute, but I just don't feel close to God. As if that's the mark of spiritual maturity too. Now, there are times when I feel close to God, and I'm really grateful for that. But there are times, as we've stated in our church, that sometimes God removes his affectionate or effectual presence from us So it feels like we're in the desert, spiritual desert. And not necessarily because we've done something wrong. It's just part of God's redemptive work in our lives to build down into our hearts. But sometimes we make our spiritual feelings the measurement of how we're doing spiritually. And then whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, it's easy to substitute good deeds as a substitute for really living out the gospel and obedience. In the final analysis, all of these things are substitutes for the real measurement of our spiritual maturity is our obedience. Our obedience, which is what Jesus is going to say in our parable. In Matthew chapter 7, he is finishing what we call the Sermon on the Mount. And he finishes with this sort of putting us into the distant future. Question in your handout is it enough to say the right things? Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. This is a fascinating picture, a visual. And the visual is something like this. Now, none of us have ever been to heaven. We don't know what it looks like. We have sort of word pictures that are suggestive, illustrative language, allegorical language that is suggestive. But in the final analysis, we really don't know what it looks like. But here he says, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, this is just me speculating, but I have a picture in my mind of this grand palace, this large stone walls. If you've ever been to Jerusalem or seen pictures of the wall around the city, it's sort of that type of thing. And heaven is inside the gates, inside the wall. And Jesus paints a picture of people who are coming up to the gate with the anticipation that, of course, they're going to be let into heaven. No question about that. And it's just no question. And they say, Lord, Lord. They know the right theology. They have the spiritual passion. And they are in for the surprise of their life and their death. He says, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. It's not the right theology, not the right passion. It has to do with our obedience, our obedience. Verse 22, on that day, many will say to me, and there I picture a crowd of people, more and more people coming, and people are confused. They don't know why the gate hasn't opened for them. And more people are coming. Many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name? Did we not cast out demons in your name? Do many mighty works in your name? They think about their good deeds. Not the profession, not their spiritual passion, not their good deeds, whether they be Christian good deeds or the non-Christian who says, well, certainly, if my good deeds outweigh my bad deeds, I'll make it into heaven. Neither one of those seem to be impressive to him. When I think about saying the right things, I think about when I was 12 years old in our church. This was the Episcopal Church. And I'm not saying anything bad about the Episcopal Church when I say this. I'm just telling you some of my personal story. At 12 years old, you went through what was called confirmation. It was a series of about 10 or 12 weeks of classes. And the idea was to help a young person, a 12-year-old, confirm their faith. They've already come to faith somewhere along the line, and now they're sort of owning it as the idea. Now, I really didn't understand that. But I went through the classes, and you have to memorize a lot of stuff. We had to memorize the Lord's Prayer. Did that. Had to memorize Psalm 23. Did that. Had to memorize the Nicene Creed. Did that. There were pages and pages of questions and answers that you were going to be asked on a Sunday morning, along with the other, I think there were five or six of us 12-year-olds, and we were supposed to be, you know, sitting up here, and we were supposed to answer exactly with the answer that was printed in the page. We had to memorize all that stuff. And the group of us, we did all that. We memorized all that. Had all that down. But I was no more a Christian than the chair that I was sitting in just a few minutes ago. Now, I didn't know it at the time. I just assumed like the people Jesus is saying in this story, extrapolating into the future. I was very similar to these folks. Now, what he says is there's a necessity of doing his will. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. It's not, if you'd asked me in college before I became a Christian, if Jesus died on the cross, I would have said, yeah. Did he die for sins? I would have said, yes. Do you believe in the Trinitarian God? I would have said, yes. Do you believe that the Holy Spirit exists? I would have said, yes. I would have been able to answer a lot of theological questions. But the theological questions I could answer did not in no way translate into my moral choices my first few years in college. I knew these things, and I just sort of lived as if that was enough. Verse 22, on that day many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, cast out demons in your name, do many mighty works in your name? Now, what he's saying here is when he gives them the bad news at the gates there, not everyone says to me, Lord, Lord, this is their response. This is what they're really trusting in. But look at all the good things that we did. How could we not get into heaven? And he says, then I will declare to you, and he tells them two really important things. I never knew you. I never knew you. Depart from me, you evildoers. Now, what does he mean, I never knew you? Now, if you'd asked me in college, do I know Jesus, I would have said yes. Meaning, I knew about him. I knew he existed. I knew a lot of things about him. I could tell you some of the things he did, tell you about the miracle, could tell you about the Last Supper, could tell you about his the different trials he went through, his suffering, the Garden of Gethsemane, could have told you about the cross and the resurrection. Is that what he means here? A list of knowledge things? I never knew you. What he's saying here is, you've called me Lord, 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 but there's a difference between knowing that I am the Lord and being your Lord. You did not know me as your Lord. I did not know you as the master of your life. You were still the master of your life, the Lord of your life. You did what you wanted to, assuming that the right theology in your head, you knew what to do. And then he says, depart from me, you evildoers, meaning this. The problem of sin has never been addressed in your life. That fundamental issue in your heart. What you tried to do to mask over that is all kind of substitutes. Good deeds, right theology, be a good person, give to the church, go to a Bible study, try to treat people nicely, etc., etc. But none of those are good substitutes for the reality of what's going on inside of your heart, the reality of sin. Being saved by the power of the gospel from your sin. None of those two things were addressed. Now, it's at this point that he tells them a parable to drive home this reality. Now, if you look at that, when you look at a parable, you always look at what the context is. He's finishing up Matthew 7, the Sermon on the Mount. And he has really three parables that he sort of piggybacks one after the other. And it's just fascinating to think about this. The first one has to do with two gates and two roads, Matthew 7, 13, and 14. Enter by the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many go that way. But small is the gate, narrow the door that leads to life. Only a few find it. And by inference, one of the applications is something along this line. As you're becoming a Christian, you realize that this is not just knowing fun facts to know and tell about the gospel, but you are going to walk through a narrow gate, through a narrow road of life. And it's important to start that way and to stay on that narrow road because it has a good ending, at least to life. That's the first parable. The next parable after that, he talks not two roads, not two gates, but two trees. And he talks about fruitful tree and an unfruitful tree. And that over time, as we're walking along the narrow road, what we should see is something of good trees and fruit in our life that displays something of that we are walking along the road of life. There's the fruit of character in our life and the fruit of a difference in how we treat people. Fruit of holiness should be evident. Not that we're perfect at all, none of that. But you should see some fruits along the way, and they almost serve as sort of mile markers along the way that say, yes, you're on a good road. As opposed to the bad fruit trees, where there's no fruit on those trees, and there are mile markers that say, are you sure you're on the right road? Now, the third parable that we're looking at today, the parable of the different foundations, is not about the beginning of our Christian life, the gate and the roads. It's not about the continuing through the course of life on the two roads and the trees, but it's a picture of the end of our life, or final judgment. That's what we're going to look at here. And it gives two possibilities, either building a foundation on rock or building on sand. So we'll look at the building a foundation on the rock first. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them, will be like a wise man who built his house upon the rock. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon that house. But it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. Now, when I think about this, there are several pictures that come to mind. Perhaps you remember the tsunami in Thailand about roughly 10 years ago. And one of the pictures that is indelibly etched in my mind is a picture from the sky over an area that was just completely leveled. All you see is a field of debris where there used to be houses, except for one large white sort of, I think of it as a sort of, I don't know, I think of it as India, but it's not, obviously not Indian, but large building that somehow withstood that. That's something of the picture that he's painting here. When I was a kid, about third or fourth grade, our family moved to New Orleans, Louisiana, and we moved to my folks bought a house in a brand new subdivision that used to be a forest. And every Saturday or Sunday, we would drive out there once a week, and we would look at the progression of all the houses being built on our street. And I remember, you know, at first there were the bulldozers out there knocking down trees for the lots and carting off that stuff, and the grading of the land, and the cement trucks, you know, come out, and the guys running the sewer lines and water lines. And I was, you know, the concrete truck for the foundation. And I got excited when I started to see the walls go up. I remember that, the wood framing going up and the trusses going up. And another week you go out there and you'd see the roof and you'd see windows and doors put in and the walls put in. And every week's kind of like, what are you going to see out there? And eventually all the houses were done. Now, unlike so many developments today, in that subdivision, there was just not one builder who was building all the houses. There were a bunch of them. They were all competing to buy lots, to buy a place, and then to sell to people like my folks who wanted to build a house there. I still remember kind of when we were all done, all the kids were out there, and you walk into your house and that new house smell, which turns out to be just paint and new carpet, I think. But, you know, when you're a kid, that's magic. And nobody had any landscape. You know, that wasn't part of the deal. You know, my dad had to put in the landscape, you know. But we didn't care. Kids running up and down the street, all brand new houses. That is until we had some type of tropical storm. I don't remember what kind it was. But I remember my mom going to the store and buying candles and water and flashlights. And my dad putting up, hammering plywood up on anything glass around the edge of our house. I remember being inside with the lights out, candles going on. I could still can hear the rain and the wind howling outside. And every once in a while, you would hear something shattering or breaking in the neighborhood. Well, the storm finally passed, and when it did, everybody went outside. And much to my surprise, there were some houses that didn't have all that much damage to them. And there were some houses that had a lot of damage to them. Some folks didn't have a roof anymore. Some people didn't have walls anymore. You'd see some appliances, you know, it's kind of scattered all about some people's yards. No, what was the difference? in the course of our parable, what he would say is the foundation or the quality of the building materials that were used. Luke 6:48, Luke records another detail that Matthew doesn't record in the telling of this story. He is like a man building a house who dug deep. Now, in the using illustrative language, what he's saying is not just somebody who does my word, but makes it a priority. I'm going to obey God's word as much as I can, whatever it costs me. The idea of digging deep here. Laid the foundation upon rock. When a flood arose, the stream broke against that house and could not shake it because it had been built. James 1:22 is some familiar passages. It says, be doers of the word and not hearers only deceiving yourself. Be doers of the word. It's not enough to be a hearer, as Jesus says. And then the rest of this I've had some recent experience with. If anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who observes his natural face in a mirror. Think about getting up in the morning and looking at the mugshot you see in front of you. Yeah, it's not pretty. He observes himself and goes away at once and forgets what he was like. Now, this past week, I got to go up to the mountains for a three-day retreat. I like to do this about three or four times a year. Study retreat, planning retreat, just kind of get away and refresh and talk to some other pastors. We were up at a camp in Crestline. Now, I took a shower last Sunday morning for church. My friend, pastor friend, is coming to pick me up on Monday, this past Monday, at 8. And I kind of knew that I was going and kind of lollygagged around and didn't take a shower, didn't shave. And then I looked, I was reading and doing some other stuff, and I realized he was going to be here pretty quick. And so I thought, well, I'll just take a shower when I get up there, just shave when I got up there. We got up to the camp. Got moved in. We went over to where we were staying, 15 of us in this large room. I got the coffee going. Got a fire going without burning anything down. Although I did fill up our room several times with smoke. I apparently make fires like I cook. Was there all day. Didn't look in a mirror all day until Tuesday morning. Didn't shower Monday. Didn't shave, nothing. Tuesday, my alarm went off at 5:30. I got up, got out of our bunk, walked across the camp to where we were staying, got the coffee started, got the fire going, turned the lights on, started reading. Didn't look in a mirror. Didn't shave. Didn't shower. All day Tuesday. There's more. Wednesday morning, I fell asleep about 9:30 at night, both Monday and Tuesday night, at the table with all the lights on, all the guys there, head on, and I just needed to go. Didn't brush my teeth, didn't look in the mirror. Maybe that is too much information. Wednesday morning, got up, did the same thing. And we left after breakfast. Now, I was getting ready to leave, and I said to my friend, my pastor friend, who drove up, I said, I have not taken a shower since Sunday. Now, we've got time. I can go take one now if you think that would be important for the hour and a half drive home. He walked over and he said, no, you're good. Now, when I got home about noon. I looked in the mirror for the first time since Sunday. I looked like I made a homeless guy look good. I had that just awful scruffy, and with the gray and black in my beard, that's not a good combination. And I could tell it didn't smell it wasn't fresh. It was kind of, that's what I think of. If anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who observes his natural face in a mirror. He observes himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like. Now, I don't think anybody else in that room would forget what I look like, but I did. He who looks into the law of liberty, and perseveres in doing, being no hearer that forgets, but a doer that acts, he shall be blessed in his doing. The second foundation upon which we can build is sand. Again, Matthew 7:26. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them. Oh, that's a good sermon, Seth. I like that. Good stuff. Now, I don't know about you. I forget what I speak on by about Tuesday. So if you forget, that's okay. The question is not if you heard a good sermon. Well, there's something I'm going to do as a result of this. That's really all that matters. There's something I'm going to do differently because of this. And does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, the winds blew, beat against that house. All the same thing that happens to the guy who built his house on the rock and the sand. Same storm. It fell, and great was the fall of it. Does the date August 23rd, 2005 ring a bell for anybody? Katrina. Hurricane Katrina. Now, this is one of those news events that started on August 23rd and seemed like it never ended. The news about Hurricane Katrina just kept going on and on and on. And the images in your mind and my mind are pretty riveting. See, people out there stuck on their roof waiting for a helicopter or a boat to come by or somebody to come by with food and water. Or people wading through waist-deep water down Canal Street in a particular ward of the city. Or people whose house is up to about here in water. There are a lot of images. People at the Superdome, sleeping, looking for food. A lot of images. I have aerial images of seeing this, the devastation in southern Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, panhandle of Florida. That's something of what he's describing here. Now, this is a picture of final judgment. There's a similar picture in 1 Corinthians 3, 10 through 15, with a different image to it. And that is that how we lived our life and what we really live is going to go through the test of fire. And anything that, again, in the imagery of language, anything that we live for that would be considered wood, hay, or stubble, it's going to be gone at fire. People are going to realize that what they lived their life for, their short time here, it's like ash sitting in that fireplace. Do you live your life for control? To be in charge of your life? Fire. You live your life for possessions? Ash. Live your life to feel a sense of importance as you're relating to the people around you? Ash. Live really primarily with your needs first in mind as you relate to the people around you? Ash. Love to feel good at the moment, no matter whether it's you should be doing this or not, or if it affects somebody else? Ash. Same imagery as rubble after a hurricane. Ezekiel 33, God speaks to the prophet Ezekiel. He says, as for you, son of man, meaning Ezekiel, your people who talk about you by the walls and at the doors of the houses say to one another, each to his brother, come and hear what the word is that comes forth from the Lord. So, you know, you look at that and as a pastor, you think, well, that's good. You know, are our folks out there looking forward to what they're going to hear on Sunday and that God's going to speak to them? That's what you hope for. But then God tells Ezekiel the bad news. They come to you as my people come. And they sit before you as my people. And they hear what you have to say. But they will not do it. For their heart is set on their own gain. I'll obey God as long as I can see there's a connection to how I live and what I want to feel and what I want. But if it doesn't make that kind of connection with me, I'm not going to do it. I may be able to talk about it, say things about it. And verse 32, and lo, you are to them, God speaking to the prophet, you are, Ezekiel, you are to them like one who sings love songs with a beautiful voice and plays well on an instrument. For they hear what you say, but they will not do it. Building on sand. Now he finishes this parable, and he gets done with this. And verse 28 says, and when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching. And the Greek word of astonished means they were astonished at the moment, and they continued to be astonished long after he got done speaking. Something struck them. Something powerful impacted them. For he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes. Now, what Matthew is saying here is, it's not that he taught, as we would say, authoritatively. That's a good thing to do. We all appreciate that kind of speaker, but that's not what he's saying. He's saying something different. Jesus spoke as one who was in authority and commanded obedience. That's different. And that should catch our attention. On the back of your handout, Jesus is talking to the scribes and some of the Pharisees. In John 7, he says, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. I'm not just making this up. It isn't just like a good sermon I thought of last night, and I'm going to give it to you guys. The idea is that he's gotten his assignment from God, and he's trying to give to the people what he's heard God say to tell the people. The issue here is authority again. And then he says, if any man's will is to do his will, meaning the problem is not with the speaker. If there's a problem, it's with the listener. And it has to do with our will. If anybody's will is to do his will, then he shall know whether my teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority. But if we're the other kind of person, if anybody's will is to do what he's going to do, what he wants to do, even if what I'm telling him or what God is saying is different, then you're never going to know if this is God speaking to you and what God has to say to you. You have usurped that authority to yourself. And his teaching will seem only to you as ideas over which to ponder and maybe talk about at lunch. Proverbs 2, 1 through 5, Solomon says, my son, if you treasure up my words within you, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. If you look for it as, if you search for it as for hidden treasure, you seek it like silver, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. He's talking about obedience. Not just fun facts to know and tell as I did my Bible study or heard a sermon. In our culture absolutely hates the idea that Jesus said there's only one way to heaven. It looks at that with just like nails on a chalkboard. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus again puts in contrast, there are really only two options for human nature. There are only two gates. There are only two roads. You'll see two different kinds of signposts along the way with trees. And in the final analysis, you're going to see the fruit of your work based on the foundation upon which you lived your life. And all along the way, there are really only two options from his point of view, though our culture says, oh, any way, there are hundreds of ways to go. He says there are really only two. It's the way of obedience to what God tells you to do, or the way of disobedience, plus any substitute you want to add that makes you think you're doing okay. That's it. You can add a religious substitute to that. You can add an irreligious substitute to that. You can lead a person that's just highly devoted to some religion. But as long as you hold the card that I'm going to do what I want to do, you're on the wrong road, he says. Obedience or disobedience plus any substitute you want to add. Obedience is important. Discipline is important. In the Royal Navy, a number of years ago in Britain, there was a scandal. And the scandal had to do with what a lot of people thought was extreme punishment for a small breach of discipline by one of the sailors in the Royal Navy. And the usual culprits came out to write letters and phone in and write articles in the paper about the military and why they would do, and this is overkill, and why would they do something so outrageous, this extreme punishment for what looked like a small breach of discipline. And, you know, they were calling for hearings in Parliament and all the stuff that you look at the news and you just go, oh, golly. You know. Until an ex-Navy sailor wrote a letter to the editor, and back then it sort of went viral, as we would talk about it today. And the ex-sailor said in his letter that many people think that there was an overkill of punishment for a seemingly small lack of discipline. But when you're in the military, there is no such thing as a small act of discipline. All of your training is meant to trust your commanding officer, and whether or not you see danger or not, you follow your commanding officer's lead and commands. Because you are trained that not to do so could not only cost you your life, it could cost you the life of some of the guys next to you. There is no such thing as a small breach of discipline, because what they're trying to train you in as a sailor or an army man or Air Force is when discipline is called for, it's immediate. Doesn't matter if it's great. Doesn't matter if it's small. And he told this story, true story. He was on a Royal Navy ship one night out in the North Atlantic with a storm raging across the North Atlantic. And they'd been called upon to rescue a large boat that had lost its engines and was at the mercy of the seas. It was at night. There was a ferocious storm, waves up and down. What should have been a normal rescue operation of taking their hawser steel cable and attaching it to the other ship and towing it back into port, what should have been easy, became fairly treacherous in those seas, raging seas, and at night, darkness. I had a hard time seeing. They got the cable attached to the large, much larger boat than the one they had, and they were slowly hauling this larger boat back towards Britain. The captain was having a hard time up in the wheelhouse keeping that steel cable taut with all the escalating waves. And at one point, the commanding officer on the deck yelled out as loud as he could, "Down!" He said at that moment, every sailor on the deck hit the deck with their stomach and their face down. Now, they had no idea why. But what the guy on the deck could see was that the hawser cable, this big steel cable was pulling this large ship behind them, had snapped. And it was flying back their way. And within seconds, the fragments of that cable were doing havoc all across the top of that deck of that ship, just above the bodies of the sailors who were laying down. And the sailor said, if any one sailor had turned around to say, "Well, why do I have to do that?" His last word on earth would have been, "Why?" And that steel cable would have cut him in two. That's sort of the force of this parable we've looked at today. We have a chance to look far into the future, at least as we think of in human terms. For some of us, that's probably nearer than for some of you. And the question to ask yourself is, on what am I really building? Do I hear God's word? Do I go, yeah, it's good stuff. I really like that. No, I never really thought about that thought. Yeah, it's good. I think I'll write my sister a letter and tell her I really like that part. Or am I sitting here thinking, God, what do I do from today? Are you trying to speak to me? There's something different in how I live. There's something regarding holiness. Something related to my husband or my wife. Something related to my 19-year-old that's now living with her boyfriend. Father, as we think about this parable, it's such a privilege and a blessing to see what's coming and to prepare now for it. And Father, I, like probably everybody in this room, fights to be obedient. There's something about that we just don't like, and we probably never will. And we will fight that all of our lives. But at least we come to you and say, God, help us, have mercy on us. Help us to bend our will and bow ourselves to you. Remind us of the importance of obeying you and building a life on rock. And as we think about this parable, what do you want us to do? How do you want us to relate differently? Are there measures of holiness that need to be shaped up? Things we need that we've been toying with that we shouldn't be, that we need to put aside? Maybe we need an accountability partner. Maybe there's something we need to come clean about with a good friend. Maybe we've been harboring resentment and bitterness and just sort of petting it in the quiet of our room at home instead of forgiving, extending mercy like we've been given mercy.